The radio brings into the home, the schoolroom, the hospital, and news of world events.
We're going old school.
This is Throwback Thursday. Digging up something from the past.
Dusting it off and making it new again.
Throwback Thursday
on PT Pintcast.
So we're starting off the Throwback Thursday series by going back to episode number 4. This episode was released on September 1st, 2015. It was one of our original six-pack episodes, and it's with Eric Mera, sports PT out of Black Diamond PT in Oregon. He's also the host of PT Inquest and PT Podcast, which you can also find on iTunes. Nice enough to say yes to a third-year PT student starting his own podcast when I didn't have an episode to even show him as an example. Eric talks about his path to becoming a PT, and specifically a sports PT, and gives some advice to PT students who want to set themselves apart. Take a listen, our first Throwback Thursday on PT Pintcast.
This is the PT Pintcast, a podcast that talks about physical therapy over beer. Bringing together clinicians, researchers, and forward-thinking PTs in a show that's anything but boring.
Let there be beer!
This is the PT Pintcast with your host, Jimmy McKay.
So the next episode of the PT Pintcast, want to welcome a guy who's on Twitter, at Eric Mera. Calls himself a science advocate, a skeptic, and a PT, which I think is a pretty good trio of things to be. He's got not one, but two podcasts. He lives in Portland with his wife, Kristen, and their daughter, Alex. He is Eric Mera, and he's nice enough to join us on the PT Pintcast tonight. Eric, thanks for coming in and having a drink with us, man.
Yeah, no problem, Jimmy. Thanks for having me. Yeah, the podcast, as you mentioned, there's the two that I host, PT Podcast and PT Inquest. And PT Inquest, I have a co-host with J.W. Matheson. And then, yeah, we launched, we have two others on the PT Podcast Network. We just launched Pain Science and Sensibility with Sandy Hilton and Corey Blickenstaff. And we also have the NAF Physio Podcast, which I assist Adam Meekins with producing that.
How'd you get to the connection of going from being a PT to recording stuff and putting it out there? What was kind of your calling for that?
I was trying to find ways to reach out to younger physical therapists. You know, I was thinking that my path becoming I'm in sports medicine, and one of the things I had a big issue with when I was kind of coming up was there is no roadmap, so to speak. There was no I had no idea how to get into sports medicine. Sports medicine has always been kind of a competitive type thing, and there just seemed like there was no real opportunity. So as I kind of beat my way through and got worked my way up within the sports section and that kind of thing, I came up with this idea to do a educational session at Combined Sections meeting, titled it The Many Faces of Sports Physical Therapy. And I just wanted to parade up a bunch of people from the sports section just to have them talk about how they got to where they are and what their path was and what kinds of information they could pass on. And we joked about it because we had, I think we had 8 speakers. And we were just joking around saying, you know, we're going to have more speakers than we have actual attendees. Nobody's going to come to this. And when this was about 5 years ago in San Diego, and what ended up happening is the room was so crowded that the speakers couldn't even get into the room to speak because there's so many young new professionals that were there and students that were just really interested in that. So that kind of blew us away of how many people really kind of identified with that. So I did that for a couple of years, and then, you know, listening to some podcasts myself that were unrelated to physical therapy, and I started thinking, you know, wouldn't it be cool if somebody were to just kind of sit down and kind of start interviewing some people who had some insight into physical therapy, kind of like the thought with Many Faces. So, you know, just contacted a couple of friends I knew and said, hey, would you mind if I just got a microphone and we, you know, talked for about an hour and just talk shop, talk about how you got to where you are and these types of things. And that's how I was born with the first one, the PT Podcast.
What are you drinking tonight? That's an important question.
Oh, sorry, that's actually rum and coke.
Rum and coke. I'm going with the New Belgium Skinny Dip. I'm trying to have a different beer for each episode just to kind of change
it up. Well, I mean, I'm in Portland, Oregon, so beer is a huge thing here. So sometimes you gotta break ranks a little bit.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your clinic, Black Diamond PT, and you're mm-hmm. into sports, as you said, educated at the University of Florida, sports yep. medicine internship with the NCAA Division I football team. That's a pretty sweet gig to be doing PT for the Florida Gators, man.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was an intern athletic trainer, actually. So at that level, again, you got to keep in mind this was 95, 96. So back then, to become an athletic trainer, you just had to put in the hours, and then it was basically like an apprenticeship. They've progressed very far, much like the physical therapy profession as well. Back then, also, you know, as a PT, it was a bachelor's program. Now we have the doctorate. So, but at the time, I was putting in my hours to become an athletic trainer, and they had a program at the university where you could go in as an undergrad and you interviewed for a position, and then they would just stick you in with whatever team they decided. And I got stuck in with football.
Stuck in with football. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I was probably more interested in being on women's volleyball team, but,
you make a really good counter argument there. And I'm actually 100% with you now.
Yeah. So I ended up with football. It was a great experience. And also I kind of realized in that setting, I didn't want to be the employee of an athletic team. I would rather work as an outside consultant. So I would see the outside physical therapists that were working with the team, and I kind of identified more with that type of setting. And that's more the direction I went after I left.
And why is that? So you could get variety, or what? What was the holdback for just being with one team?
No, there's the issues with, and it's not so much even being with one team. It's being an employee of the program. So you kind of come from the side, and people who work in professional sports understand this as well, is that the second you work for the team, you are considered by the players to be on the side of management. So, and not that that's accurate by any means, but there is kind of a sense of sometimes, you know, when you're talking contracts, when you're talking performance, things like that, there can be an adversarial positioning between the players and the organization itself. You know, sometimes it was hard to get the players to trust you. There was also, and this isn't unique to any particular program, but, you know, kind of do whatever the athlete wants type situations as well. You're an employee of the school, so if the athlete wants, you know, some crazy different treatment, if you can't do it, they're going to find somebody that can, and for your job to kind of depend on that. I didn't really like that as much. As opposed to being an outside consultant, I can come in, I'm just very objective, going to look at the case, I'm going to review it, I'm going to give my input. I can, sometimes it's almost like you're selling what you're going to do. You have to lay out your treatment plan, what you plan on doing, and then they have to accept it, and then you go forward from there. Always from kind of that outsider position.
That's cool. So it's more in terms of you're an advocate for the patient. You don't need to worry about, you know, is the team going to be okay with your course of treatment and how fast you're going to get that athlete back on the field?
Yes and no, because the other part is, you know, the university will, you know, the patient's insurance company, and then the university will pay the remainder of my services. And, you know, the university talks to me because I understand the demands of the athlete, and I understand that it's not just simply, oh, well, they're having pain, just shut them down for 2 weeks. There's a lot of complexity to that. So that's kind of the dance you do with sports medicine, is how can I still get what I can out of this athlete and really make a judgment call as to the athlete's safety, whether or not this is going to lead to a further injury, whether or not this is something that can be played through, and how to manage that the best. So there's really a fine line in sports medicine, especially at that level, of trying to determine what's best for the athlete and also best for the team, keeping in mind that the athlete's going to come first.
Do you do any consulting now for any teams?
I do a lot of work with the University of Portland, which is a Division I school here in Portland. We also do a lot with some of the Pac-12 teams that typically a lot of the athletes in the Pac-12, a lot of them come from Portland. So during summers, we'll pick up a lot of those. And then any local professional athletes who happen to live in town, sometimes we'll pick up their kind of off-season programming, things like that.
So how difficult is it for a new DPT graduate to get into sports PT?
Well, there's a lot of different ways. The biggest thing that you have to realize when it comes to sports medicine is that there's kind of a sense of everybody wants to work with the athletes. So you have to make a lot of sacrifices in order to be able to do that. So there's a lot of taking a really low-paying job, low on the totem pole at a university. There's doing a residency or a fellowship under somebody at a program. There's also, you know, I did it the private practice way, which I opened up a clinic and I said, I work with athletes, and I put my foot down. And, you know, when that workman's comp case comes up that's going to pay you lots of money, you know what? go somewhere else. When that auto accident case comes up and wants to pay a lot of money, you know what? Go somewhere else. So instead of just taking whatever is going to come through your door, to really streamline and be a specialist in what you are, that's the one thing that, you know, we pride ourselves on, specifically my practice, is that I hardly ever, you know, maybe once a year I'll bill Medicare for something. Most of my patients, you know, weekend warrior type things, they're all young, active, mostly high school, college athletes. And that's because I took the time to learn everything I could about them and then make sure I catered my services to them. So if I get a lot of reps in treating a lot of chronic pain and treating a lot of back pain and that kind of stuff, I'm going to get really good at that, but I'm not going to be very good working with athletes. So if you want to work with athletes, you just really have to just kind of pay your dues and make sure that you just kind of stick to it and don't just go for, well, this is an easy opportunity. I have an opportunity to do this over here. I'm going to go ahead and just do that.
So how long have you had Black Diamond?
Started Black Diamond in 2003. So,
and when you put that out there, I mean, this is like kind of a sports question mixed with a private practice question. So you're just saying you put it out there, you hung up your slate and said, I'm a sports therapy PT practice, and you stuck to that.
Yeah, and you know, a little more history is, you know, I did have a background working with the university. I did, you know, when I got out, I worked at George Washington University Hospital for a couple of years, and I kept trying to get my roots in with their athletics department and things like that. I wasn't getting a lot of traction. And then I decided, you know what, if nobody else is going to teach me this stuff, I'm just going to teach myself. So I started studying to become a certified strength and conditioning specialist. That's what, to understand it from that perspective. I started trying to shadow any athletic trainers or physical therapists that let me just, you know, put in some hours of shadowing. I started working towards my SCS, picking up on-call work that would allow me to work more of a sports medicine type thing, just to try to get my hours and get my experience in. And then I actually started volunteering my services as a strength coach with professional golfers in the area. And that's actually how the business started, was working with those guys. And then as they would get injuries, they would want me to actually work with them with their injuries as well. And that's actually how I learned how to bill an insurance company, was somebody said, well, I have this medical insurance. Why can't you just charge them for, you know, rehabbing my shoulder now that it's hurting? My reply was, I don't know. I can't. So just calling the insurance company and saying, I'm a licensed provider. Here's my social security number. How do I bill you? And they laid it out for me. And that's how I first started billing insurance companies. And then it just kind of grew from there.
It sounds like you did a lot of the hard work in terms of doing stuff for free, in terms of you know, implanting yourself within the culture of athletes. And if there's one thing that athletes do is they talk, and I'm sure that paid dividends.
The first two golfers I trained for free. They were guys I had met through, I don't golf, but I met them through some other, you know, I actually picked up a job one day a week working at a large sporting goods store that sold fitness equipment. And I did one day a week there just to learn more about how fitness equipment is put together, what makes a good piece versus a bad piece, things like that. And it was just an opportunity just to do that on the side. And there was a golf shop that had golf professionals that were there, and I just became friends with them. And then I said, hey, you know what? I've learned all this stuff about strength and conditioning, and I want to kind of use it on someone. And I trained them for one off season. They went to the first professional event that year, and they destroyed the rest of the field. And then the rest of that year, I had a very packed facility with all the other golfers. So,
Yeah, word spreads, and good news spreads pretty quick.
Yep.
You're pretty involved with, you know, students and the APTA. And I was looking at your involvement with the sports section of the APTA. Specifically, Eric founded and chaired the HIP Special Interest Group, and he's also a member of the Shoulder, Knee, and Intercollegiate Professional Sports SIGs. That's a great way to get involved. I've jumped in on a lot of those things so far. That's kind of how this podcast came about. What got you inspired about that?
Yeah, so that's the biggest thing is the way I got involved with the sports section is actually I was wanting to become certified as a sports certified specialist. And what ended up happening is in order to do that, you have to become emergency responder certified so that you can do sideline activities. So the sports section puts on courses around the year. It's actually American Red Cross first responders, the designation that you get. But the sports section does that certification with a perspective from a sports medicine view. So you learn more how to cut off a face mask. You learn how to stabilize somebody on a backboard, how to handle a fracture, how to do all these things. So it was going to one of those courses that I met Teresa Schumann, who is she's currently the secretary of the sports section, but she was teaching the course. And I just said, I really want to learn this stuff and I want to know it inside and out. How can I learn these? And basically she said, just get involved with the section. So then reaching out to the section, hey, how can I help? I'm going to volunteer, showing up at CSM, helping out with that kind of stuff. And then what ended up happening with me is I started getting really involved in young adult hip. So a lot of the athletes that would have these hip injuries were trying to figure out what was going on. So I was, through my own literature review, started to kind of collect a lot of data, a lot of information on femoral acetabular impingement and labral tears. And this is back in the mid 2000s. So, I mean, nobody was talking about this stuff at that time. And then when I had it all kind of compiled, I was like, well, geez, wouldn't it be great if there was some way to disseminate this kind of information? And I looked at the special interest groups within the sports section and saw that, you know, there's knee, there's shoulder, there was some of these other ones, but there was nothing for the hip specifically. So that's when I started a petition to get that started. And that was the funny thing is I was just kind of going around saying, somebody really should start this. And then they're like, well, you would do that by doing a petition. The next thing I know, they're basically turning to me, all right, now that we started it, you're the chair. And go ahead and lead it. So,
you built the ship. Guess what? You're behind the helm. So
yeah, you got 3 years now.
Go for it. So being that I'm a DPT student and I am interested in sports, you have obviously some interaction with DPT students. How do you know what's kind of a tell or what's an indicator that the DPT student comes to you and says, listen, Eric, I'm really interested in this. What's something you see in that student, whether you know either they're going to make it or they're not, or this is a short-term or long-term thing?
Super easy question. When you ask them to do something, they do it. It's as simple as that. We see that's a mantra within the sports section is, hey, you volunteered to show up and help set up chairs for this event. Show up. It's as simple as that. Because you'd be amazed how many people don't. They get the opportunity and then they just don't step through that door. So that's the big thing is when you offer your help to do something, be there. And then don't complain about the fact that you're not getting paid. Don't complain about the fact that all your friends went out drinking while you're staying late to help set up an event for the next morning. Because what you may not realize is the person that's helping you happens to be the past president and maybe the founding editor of JOSBT or something like that. And you're just hanging out, chatting with them as you're setting up chairs. That's really, that big opportunity. But that's the thing with sports medicine. It's almost kind of quasi-military, and it's very much a matter of you show up, you do your part happily, you make mistakes, you own up to your mistakes, and you just be honest and you just do everything you can to make that happen. There are many people much smarter than I am that haven't gotten as far with this kind of stuff just because they're not willing to put in the time.
I've talked to some students, and I think I've found that some of the students maybe are hesitant to do something like that or to volunteer just because they're almost like, I think I'm being too forward. It's almost like I've heard that from a bunch of students.
They've ASAP. Actually done studies on that, on the fear of rejection that humans have just in general. They have a horrible fear of rejection. So there's actually a funny, there's a guy, I'm blanking on his name now, but he did this as a YouTube thing first, and then he wrote a book about it where he tried to get 100 rejections. Because he figured he was so afraid of rejection. He always felt so devastated when somebody said no to him. He said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go get exposed to rejection. So he went out of his way to solicit rejections on things. And he went about and he would ask for just the most insane things from like a hotel. So you show up at a hotel. Hey, can I have a free room? And you know they're going to say no. And that's what he's looking for is to rack up repetitions of rejection so he could become some graded exposure, basically. And what he found is that surprisingly, more often than not, people would, if they said no, they would usually offer something else that was usually pretty good. And this is absolutely true when you're looking to move your career up is the number of times I just say, hey, do you mind if I just hang out with you in the clinic for a day? So people that you wouldn't expect would say yes to that. Most people, especially speakers at events, they're educators and they love the opportunity to share. And you got to keep in mind, a lot of them, especially as they're professors and things like that, they spend their days having people basically not want to listen to them and be bored by them.
We always want to listen. Students always want to listen.
The fact that you're actually interested and really have good questions and really think about things, it really excites them. They really get excited about it, and they'll just talk and talk and talk. So just ask. I say that all the time. It's one of the posts I wrote about staying current on literature is, if you can't get an article and you have the abstract, 9 times out of 10, the author's email address is on there. His email. Say, hey, I really am interested in your article, but I can't seem to get a copy of it because I don't have access to the journal it's published in. Do you mind sending me the PDF?
And that wouldn't be too forward? That wouldn't be
annoying? Never have one say no.
Really?
Well, I don't know about that, but I you'd be amazed. Okay. There's a reason their email address is on there. And I've asked questions of authors before where I say, hey, you know, I'm reading your paper, and I had a question about this. We were designing a study. It's almost completed now. We're looking at some of the post-operative management situations for hip arthroscopy in young adults. And what we were trying to look at was very similar to another study that was done on knee immobilizers after ACL reconstruction. And a lot of the methods were incomplete in the actual published paper. So I just emailed the author and said, hey, I'm trying to do a study along these lines. You talk about this kind of this patient like diary that you had them fill out day to day on how their pain was and things like that. How was that organized? How was this, that? Next thing I know, within an hour, she sends me the actual documents, the actual pain diary as a sample of this is exactly how we did it. And so I already have it kind of pre-made for me that I just have to tailor it to our study, but I know that the bones are there that were already approved, right, and went all the way through a study that was accepted in the American Journal of Sports Medicine. I know it's already kind of got the roots there. And that was just by just firing off an email to someone who didn't know me from Adam. So, yeah, I mean, the worst thing they'll do is say no. And this has been something that the other reason that we push forward with some of the stuff, and this is the big thing behind the Science PT, which is, you know, the blog that I run. The issue that I was having as well is, as a student or as a new grad, I have a very strong science background. I was a big science geek. I still read physics books and stuff like that just because I nerd out on that kind of stuff. And when I came out of school, the place I was working, I was just surrounded by people that were doing a whole lot of hands-on stuff, a lot of, you know, modalities and a lot of things that I just didn't see a lot of evidence behind. And what was happening is I was constantly beaten down as to do it their way. And I felt back then that would have been a nice thing is if I had some sort of a voice out there saying, no, actually, you're not far off. This is how science works. This is kind of almost like a support group type situation. When you find people that really want to promote something like that, they are usually very interested in talking to darn near anybody. I do get emails all the time just from that of, hey, you know, I'm working with this. I'm a student. I have a CI that they want me to do a bunch of craniosacral therapy on every patient, and I just really don't feel like that's a good use of my time in this. How do I engage that? You know, should I talk to my school about it? You know, things like that. Where, you know, I'm happy to give whatever advice I can.
That's nice of you, because that's going out of your way, and I know a lot of students, you know, including myself, are appreciative when people do kind of go the extra mile. But you do kind of find that in PT in terms of, that's the kind of person PT kind of draws in, is a person, yeah, who's willing to help and wants to make a difference.
So yeah, cool. And as long as you come from the perspective of, this is a quick question that I expect that you'd be able to answer quickly. I had somebody actually from the UK ask me a question about correcting movement to prevent ACL injuries. I ended up writing like a 5-page email back to her.
They were not expecting that.
And it became a blog post on how to train movement and on the Science PT website. It ended up being a very popular post that I ended up using for that. But not asking what we should and shouldn't do, asking what we know and don't know, and then try to base our decisions off that.
Cool. I want to take a 60-second break. When we come back, I want to talk about a blog post that you had up. I'm a recovering functional exercise addict. My name is Eric, and I'm a recovering functional exercise addict. I want to get into that and where that came from. I also want to talk about your recent run-in with a U.S. senator and how your eye candy. We'll be back in a minute. Reload that rum and coke. I'm going to grab a beer real quick, and we'll be right back on the PT Pinecast.
Sounds good.
Cracking your back and a cold one. The PT Pinecast with McKay.
Spring is in the air. It's the season for growth and new experiences in your physical therapy career. Explore the country with healthcare staffing agency, Aureus Medical Group. You'll find rewarding travel and full-time career opportunities nationwide. Know a PT? Make a referral and earn up to $1,000. To speak with a recruiter, call 1-800-340-2619 or visit aureusmedical.com. That's A-U-R-E-U-S medical.com. Rock Tape, more than just a tape company. Rock Tape keeps athletes of all levels moving stronger, longer.
With the world's best kinesiology tape,
topical pain relief,
mobility equipment,
and protective gear.
And now physical therapists can get 20% off their first purchase right now at shop.rocktape.com.
Just use the code PTPINECAST at checkout to get 20% off.
That's shop.rocktape.com.
With the code PTPINECAST for killer savings of 20% off.
Rock Tape, the world's best kinesiology tape.
Taking IPAs over TKAs. It's the PT Pinecast.
So we're back on the PT Pinecast with Eric Mera, the science PT, at Eric Mera on Twitter. That's Eric with a K. Don't misspell it. And he's got a PT clinic out there. It is Black Diamond PT. Recently, he was eye candy on the arm of his wife for a U.S. senator. That was one of your tweets. What is that situation?
My wife used to work on Capitol Hill. We actually met in Washington, D.C. So she actually worked for Senator Murray, who's a senator from Washington State. The work that my wife does now is related. She does government affairs. You know, she goes back to Washington, D.C. probably once a month or so. And she meets with senators and congressmen. So there was an event for Patty Murray. So my wife was going, and I just tagged along. I had nothing to do with anything other than just be the eye candy. Yeah,
you can say it. Your only job was to show up and look pretty.
That's right. That's exactly right. try not to embarrass anybody.
Don't do anything stupid. Make sure you use the right fork and look pretty.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So I kind of alluded to one of your blog posts about being a functional exercise addict, a recovering functional exercise addict. Where'd that kind of come from?
I've been practicing since the mid-late 90s, and what that means more than anything is I've watched things come and go and come again. So when I was coming out, everything was very, very functional, and that was the big thing, and getting away from single-plane movements and going to multi-plane and making things, you know, simulate the sport and things like that. And the funny thing is as I practice more and more, and then also when you look at the literature more and more, is that the reality is that's not really a very effective way to go about things. And when I was coming out, I was all about, you know, function. That was the big thing, that's what differentiated me as a physical therapist versus just a gym coach or a strength coach or something. The things that we do in a weight room, for example, the primary goal there is strength and power training, maybe endurance, muscle endurance as well. Not so much coordination in a direct way, meaning you're not training movement as much as you're just training capacity to do movement. What we've seen now when you start talking about, and there's another post I have that gets into external cues versus internal cues. You can talk about dynamical systems and emergence and how movement is an insanely complex thing. And the idea, you know, take like a baseball pitcher, the idea that they are consciously thinking about everything that their shoulder muscles are doing as they're throwing a ball is just ridiculous. That's completely not possible. And what we find is that, you know, the other example I gave a little earlier, we were talking about ACL prevention strategies and things like that. What we're finding is that we do all these programs working on training somebody to be aware of where their knee is in space, and then they go out and they still tear their ACL. And the question is, well, what happened there? And the reality is what you've done in the weight room usually is you may have trained a movement, but you trained a mindful movement, meaning that when they're thinking about it, they can do it. But the second they become distracted, they go right back to their old habits and their old ways. The issue with that is that if all you've been doing is that kind of training, you didn't work on the other half of training, which is that strength and power development that they need to have. So now you have somebody that not only is going to default into a bad, quote unquote, bad pattern, they also don't have the strength to deal with it when they get there. So when you look at the injury prevention studies, and there's a great systematic review done last year by Lowerson et al. That showed that the injury prevention is actually most successful from a purely strength and conditioning perspective, meaning just get them stronger. That when you add strength to the system, not saying that movement isn't important, but movement is a very difficult thing to actually change and to have an effect on. So
how do you train that in a PT clinic?
Well, so this gets into the idea of a dynamical system or an emergent system, meaning that the first place that this was ever described was in looking at weather. So when you look at a weather system, you have all these inputs. So you have heat, you have wind, you have humidity, all these things that get inputted into it. And then from that emerges a weather system. You know a weather system is coming out of it. You just don't know exactly what that weather system is going to look like. And if you ran the exact same thing a second time, it would probably emerge as something different as well, just because the variables are so massive. There's so many variables that the slightest variation can skew it way off. That's like the butterfly effect, which actually the person who coined that, Lorenz, actually was referring it as a joke, as if the wing flap of a butterfly in Africa would
cause a tsunami somewhere else.
Right, or a tornado in the U.S. or something, because of, you know, one thing and it does all that. He never actually believed that. He was just using it as a hyperbole of what it could be. So this idea of an emergent property is that human movement is actually when you look at the variability of movement, it's all over the place. There is no perfect way to move. As a matter of fact, and this is something that I pointed out at the next conference, was that, you know, when you look at emergent type systems or dynamical systems, they have what are known as strange attractors, which are these kind of graph points that everything orbits around but doesn't actually hit. So if you look at, you take 100 different people and you look at the way they do a certain movement, you'll notice that there's variations all over the place, but they all kind of hover around a central kind of quote-unquote normal movement. But the problem is nobody actually does it that way. And what we've done inappropriately is said, well, that quote normal movement is the optimal movement, therefore let's train everybody to do that. And that's just not necessarily happening. The other thing is when you look at a dynamical system as well, is that when you're trying to manipulate the outcomes of the system, you don't try to wrestle with the weather system and corral that and force it the direction you want it to go. You try to manipulate the inputs. So when we look at the inputs of a movement system, that's where you look at the components that beget movement, strength, range of motion. It's the simple things. And that's where, you know, again, we talked about how I work a lot with professional athletes. Most of the time when a patient comes in, they've been to four different physical therapists or providers, it's something very simple that's being overlooked. It's not some complex. Usually that's they're doing the latest, trendiest new exercise or something like that. Look, you have no quad strength.
So treat it more
it's
like
just a matter of form.
So treat it more like Occam's razor, like the simplest explanation, the bits so that go in.
Exactly, yeah. So you're going to have your biggest impact by affecting the inputs. So the first thing I do, like in an evaluation of an athlete, is I just look at the most basics of movements. And so what we call, and from a strength and conditioning perspective, that's what are known as the core lifts. And I always laugh because when I say core lifts to a physical therapist, they think we're talking abdominal exercises. Core lifts, the lifts that are the core of weight training, your squats, your deadlifts, things like that. How are they doing with those types of basic movements? And then we also look at, you know, straight up quad strength, hamstring strength, just what are the components of strength that the patient may or may not have. And that's where I say my heart goes to, I want to look at their throwing mechanics. And the reality is what you want to look at is a rotator cuff strength, because that's where you can pick up on something very quickly and then make a very quick effect on that and have an effect on that before you really even necessarily need to get into throwing mechanics or landing mechanics, where we have a lot more information on. You know, when it gets to landing mechanics, I'm not saying I'm not going to work on that, but you can't do it in a mindful way. You have to do it in a distracted way, is what the evidence is showing now. So,
I'm in my first rotation right now, and when on the EMR it says do a gait analysis now, you know, right. I've noticed I can't say, can you step into the hallway and just walk down the hallway and come back? Because now that person's not going to do it like they've been doing it, because they know I'm staring at their hips and their knees and their ankles.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I want to take what we're just talking about here and go back to what you had mentioned earlier before the break with you working with some professional golfers.
Yeah.
How do you get professional golfers to trust you to buy in, even though you told me I don't play golf? What's your approach? Because that's got to be hard, right? I mean, I want to find a golfer because I'm a golfer. I want to find a football PT or strength and conditioning guy because I'm a football player. How did you go about getting golfers to trust you if you can't pick up a 9-iron?
It's very simple. I know strength and conditioning, and that's what they're coming to me for. They're not coming to me to learn how to hit a golf ball better. They already know how to hit a golf ball better. They're coming to me to build the capacity to do that work. And that's kind of the root of that that post that I had written. I talked about the golfers that I worked with back then, where I was trying to train them like golf swing type movements, and they kept not wanting to do that. They wanted to do things that would make them hit to be stronger when they got up there. You can market it as trying to, you know, you'll have people that say, I don't want to work with a guy that knows golf, and we definitely get that type of thing. But you have to bring it from the perspective of, I'm not going to mess with your golf swing. I'm not going to mess with the way you play golf. You have a golf professional for that.
You're going to go to the inputs.
I'm going to go to the inputs. Strength and range of motion. I'm going to give you better capacity to do that work. Now, the reality of it is, somebody who's going to play on the PGA Tour, the first time they picked up a golf club, they hit the ball damn well. They just naturally did that. So all I'm trying to do is just give them more opportunities to hit it well by giving them more capabilities in general. So I'm not going to work on trying to correct their swing in any way. I mean, you can go out there and, you know, I always give the example in basketball of Joakim Noah. Don't mess with the way that guy throws the ball. You know what? It's worked for him. He plays at the NBA level and he plays very, very well. What I would do with a guy like that is not correct anything about what he does mechanically. I would just try to give him the best tools that he's got, all the muscle capacity that he needs to do it, however goofy he wants to do it.
How do you tip the scales in your favor for you versus a strength and conditioning guy who's not a PT who has played golf? What sets you apart from that?
I would probably be able to take in their injury history a little better. And I will say that a good strength coach will consider injury history and then understand typical problems that may still be lingering from an old injury. So I'll kind of take that into consideration. Or if they're having recurrent injuries, try to figure out why they're having those recurrent injuries. I'll have a little better perspective of that. So it's kind of like, you know, seeing me for your meniscus tear versus seeing an orthopedic surgeon. I can still do the job, but that orthopedic surgeon is going to know a little bit more than I will because they have a little different experience. So the same thing with strength and conditioning professional may be able to do a pretty good job, but I have a little more experience with the specifics of an injury history to go with that. So that'd probably be more the perspective that I would use. It was results is what did it, because I had a couple guys that I knew that liked me and they trusted me to take them through a program. And then what they really liked, and this was an interesting thing with the golfers, is I treated them like football players almost as far as weights. I was like, here we go, we're gonna lift weights, we're gonna do squats, we're gonna do deadlifts, we're gonna do, you know, all these things. And they, for once in their careers, felt like an actual athlete, where they had, most of these guys played in college and they were always dismissed as, you know, it's more of a skill than it is an actual sport. And this was back in the time when Tiger Woods was kind of blowing up and doing coming out there with a whole lot of bringing strength and conditioning to the game. So people were all of a sudden going, I don't need to work with a golf professional anymore. I just need more strength and conditioning.
Here's another question along that same line. CSCS, mm-hmm. as a DPT student right now, second year going to my third year, is it worth it for me to get it?
Yes. So the thing, my criticism of most physical therapists is that they, and especially when we're talking an athlete, they don't understand the normal demands on an athlete. They just don't have the experience with it is what I found. And maybe that was just my training and the way I came out. But there's too many and this is actually something that the APTA in the Choosing Wisely program, where they had to pick their top five things that were of concern. One of them was that physical therapists don't load their patients heavy enough. Specifically, the elderly was one, the one that they called out in particular. But I'd say that in general, that's across the board with most of my athletes. They come in and they're like, yeah, I was working on squats. Well, what were you doing? They had me working with a couple dumbbells and I was doing I had a 20-pound dumbbell in each hand. It's like, are you kidding me? You're a Division I athlete. You need to be able to squat your body weight at least. So let's do this. But the thing is, a lot of the movements that a physical therapist is most familiar with are very simple type movements. They're not the classic weightlifting movements. I mean, I don't know. You're in school right now. I don't know if you actually get, you know, how to perform a proper deadlift, how to do a power clean, how to do You know, those types of things. So the when an athlete comes to you and says, I'm having a hard time with a power clean, you need to understand what that means.
Exactly.
And then you need to know how to train them to do it. And you need to know how to do it yourself. And so again, if you're going to be working with athletes at all, having that additional bit of knowledge that a lot of times you're going to be sending an athlete back to a strength coach who is a CSCS. And the fact that you can speak the same language as them and say, you know, I'm working on these types of things. They're having a hard time with their hip hinge. That you can actually speak that language and them understand that.
And that sells yourself to them in terms of you speaking their language. Back to the point on underloading, it's something that I probably didn't have a name for, but I noticed in my very short tenure of being in PT settings was I'd noticed we'd give people 1 or 2 pound weights to perform an activity. Yeah. And it just seemed like we were being so careful not to hurt them.
Yeah.
And then I'd watch them, you know, literally like, you know, women pick up their pocketbooks that are, you know, weighing 15 pounds and fling it over their shoulder. And I'm thinking, you know, underloading, that's perfect because I know this person's going to pick up a gallon of milk, but I'm making them do shoulder exercises with a 1 pound weight. I know he's doing more elsewhere. Why am I babying that patient? I need to push that patient.
And that's something I've noticed in ACL rehab in particular is that, especially athletes, they're just not loaded heavy enough. And the classic lifts. So, I've gone back to doing, fairly heavy back squats with our ACLs. And what I find is, this is something that I've commented on before is that, you know, you get this athlete, you put them in a single leg squat position, say in a Smith machine, so they're not dealing with balance, and you have them try to do a single leg squat. Their leg just refuses to do it, okay? But if you put them in a double leg squat, their leg, all of a sudden, because it's got its friend next to it helping it out, all of a sudden has a ton of confidence and goes through the motion just fine. So what we do is we just keep overloading that system in a double leg squat to build strength in that leg. Not worrying too much about them shifting off it because you know what? If you go heavy enough, there's only so much they can shift off. They're going to take that load. And they usually take it in a much more tolerable way in the double leg squat. And then what we find is, you know, a month later, we come back to the single leg squat and lo and behold, they now have the strength. Now their fear avoidance isn't nearly as bad as opposed to just trying to keep loading them single leg over and over again for the sake of, well, they're only weak on that side. I need to try to load that. And you end up with really light weights. You never actually push them. And the other half that we got to remember, and this is something with chronic pain as well, and we deal with our athletes too, you know, they've had a fracture or something like that. They feel fragile. So they feel like if they get loaded, they're going to break. So one of my rules is when I'm looking at an athlete is how can I put load on this person's body, on this person's frame, that's not going to exacerbate their symptoms at all and just let them feel like they can handle some weight. And again, the squat or the deadlift are usually two really good ways to do that. But sometimes, you know, I'll have somebody like with a patellar fracture and any sort of knee flexion is going to freak them out. We'll put them on an RDL, which is a straight leg deadlift, so that they can feel weight in their hands. They hinge back. They're loading their glutes and their hamstrings. But they actually feel like, and my rule is I try to get them up over 100 pounds. They feel like they can pick up 100 pounds and do something with it. That makes them feel more robust as a human and less fragile and fearful of movement.
100 pounds is most of the time a far cry from what we're loading our patients with in an outpatient ortho. I think it's probably detrimental to those patients because it's kind of like white coat PT syndrome. They come to us because we are movement experts and I'm only having them use a 2 pound weight to do this activity. And then I expect them eventually to go out and do this dynamically with more weight.
Yeah. What I used to always say is if they're going to do it out there, they need to do it in here. So that's, you know, you're going back to power cleans. Well, let's do power cleans here. And let's see where your deficit is on that. Let's see what kind of issues you're having. You give me feedback on that. And that's a big thing too when we return them to sport. You know, our ACLs, we see them until they're fully released to playing in full games. We tend to not use a whole lot of visits. I don't believe a lot of the stuff we do early on is all that helpful. And there's a lot of research that shows it's probably not all that helpful. But I like to track them out for long periods of time. And I want them going and playing in some scrimmages and then coming back and reporting to me and telling me, where were you having issues? Well, I was having issues cutting to the right. Well, let's look at what you do when you cut. Oh, you're not really bending your knee. Why aren't you bending your knee? Is it because of, you know, you look at the research. Well, they lack rate of force development. They can generate the force. They just can't generate it quickly. So we need to look at how do we classically, and this is, you know, I got to give a shout out to Rob Pinarello, who's a strength coach, physical therapist, that's helped me with some of these concepts as well. You know, say, well, you know, what is your goal? If your goal is power and rate of force development, you go to the classic lifts for that, which would be your Olympic lifts. And let's work on those Olympic lifts. So you go back to your classic, you don't try to get cute and do some funky functional recreation thing. You go back to a way that you can overload their system in the way that they're having challenges. So when they go back to the thing that's giving them a challenge, it's well below their threshold of what they can do. And that's where function improves.
What are your thoughts on loading non-athletes that much?
Well, I'll give you the example of a box squat. The box squat is basically, typically it's an 18-inch box. You usually use a plyo box, but you can use a bench. You can use a chair at the house. To keep that in mind, it's typically about 18 inches. And you just have them start from a seated position. You have them put their weight onto their feet, lean forward, and then slowly stand up from that position, and then come back down and barely touch the box without actually sitting, and then come back up. That's a simple sit to stand. You'll be amazed how many people have almost can't do that at all. That's our initial training for squatting movement, is that for them to master that. And then we just start adding weight to that. So if you have somebody that's just having difficulty with sit to stand, which that's about the most basic of
functional
orthopedic case that you're going to have, exactly, just a sit to stand. If you can get them doing a box squat with body weight without any pain, they're going to be insanely functional, as far as now they have armrests when they're at home and they get to actually give themselves a little push or something like that. It's that same idea of overload beyond what their day-to-day needs are, and then go from that. I mean, the health benefits of resistance training is just, you know, across the board huge. And again, we talked about before, the protective nature of resistance training is huge as well. And a lot of people mistake that for these people need strength. No, they need to push it. They need to move against resistance. And that has effects not just on the muscle itself, but on the nervous system and how it reacts to the loads. I think overloading even general population. I don't know that I'd be having my grandmother do 100 pounds, because let's face it, she's a beast. She can do a good 350 now. But you want to do what's appropriate for the patient. And typically, you know, when I teach like weekend courses, I talk about kind of my end goal basic program that any weekend warrior should be able to do, or my higher level athletes that are going back to a strength coach, where am I trying to get them to? And then I look at where they're trying to get to from there, and then I look at where they are when they're presenting. And then I have like phases of progression from isometrics all the way to doing Olympic lifts, and I just move them through those progressions. And the reality is, you have to make an assessment on how far does this patient need to get to be functional in their day-to-day activities. You know, if they're not going back to any sort of running or jumping, well, shoot, just doing box squats is probably as effective as I need to be. And, you know, if we have them grab a dumbbell or two to load that up a little bit so that it's heavier than body weight when they're training, so that their day-to-day activities are easy, that's, you know, plenty for them.
So since I'm a student and I want to make sure I got the notes right, if this is going to be on the test, what you're saying is real functional strength training is being strong in real-life situations, like getting up from a chair. I mean, that's functional.
Exactly. Yeah, and just giving them that base of strength that they can operate from. Because remember that even day-to-day ADL, you cannot train every single movement that patient's going to go through. So what you do is you try to give them the capacity that they can be adaptive. And that's through variations of movement that you can provide them in the clinic, and then just making sure that their muscles are able to function in lots of different ranges.
Eric, I'm really glad that you're able to display some complex thoughts in a way that students understand, because as much as I, you know, read or consume in terms of PT, sometimes it goes a little bit over my head. You know, I'm by no means the smartest guy in the room, but that's kind of where this podcast was kind of born of it. So I like how you relate it to real world situations, like your grandma squatting 350.
She's a beast.
She's a beast. So I usually ask this question of everybody we talk to is, what's one thing we should pay attention to more that we aren't?
The big thing that I stress to any intern that I have is I want them thinking critically. And that's number one. And what thinking critically means is understanding that you do not have the answers. It's as simple as that. That there's always a possibility that you're wrong. There's always another explanation out there. And not to treat any ideas too precious. You know, usually what ends up happening with a student is they try to latch on to an idea that they understand and then hold on to that as if it's infallible, can never be untrue. And they use it almost as a crutch to move themselves forward. And the reality is, you just need to be always open to different ideas and skeptical of everything. So a lot of people think that having an open mind and being skeptical of everything means that you are willing to latch on to the next cool thing. It's no. You're willing to look at the next cool thing.
Question it.
And question it. Exactly. And I think that's something I have to admit that when the DPT came about, that they were progressing to the DPT, I was a little skeptical of it because of I was worried that we would lose our pursuit of people going towards a PhD, and we would lose that research base because people would say, well, I got my doctorate, so I'm good to go, and they would lose that. But what I have to say is what it's really done is really elevated the caliber of the entry-level clinician. And by that, I mean that they are better thinkers, I think, than the people that were graduating 15, 20 years ago. Because the problem that you have is you start practicing for a little bit, and then you start to believe your own BS. And then, you know, this is my friend Mike Raymond commented on this once, that you think you got 10 years of experience, but what you actually have is 1 year of experience repeated 10 times. Because you're basically running a very small case series in your clinic of this very specific population that comes in to see you, you start to think that what you're doing is much more effective or much greater than what it actually is. And the reality is, you can never trust what you see. You can never trust your experience of that. It's always filtered by perception. So you always have to be questioning that. And anything you believe, you should have the counter argument very well established in your head of exactly what's the counter argument and what's the information, what's the evidence you're going to need to see to prove yourself wrong. Because then when it comes down the pike, you can identify it, make the change, and move forward. And that's the best way to stay cutting edge, is to be looking for the things to disprove you, not looking for the things to prove that you're right.
Well, this is essentially the type of conversation that was in my head. I did that when I said, you know, hey, having cool conversations over a drink with PT pros, this conversation that we just had is exactly what I was looking for. So I appreciate you talking to me and letting a bunch of DPT students pick your brain. So his name is Eric Mera. You can find him on Twitter at Eric with a K, Mera. TheSciencePT.com, PTPodcast.com. He's got a bunch of stuff you can listen to online right now in case you're an athlete and you're injured in the Portland area. It is blackdiamondpt.com. Hey, you can't market hard enough, right?
Well, thanks so much. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Cool. Well, I hope this isn't the last time we run into each other, and I appreciate your time over the last hour.
Yeah, no problem.
McKay, drinking, and your problems. The PT Pinecast. The PT Pinecast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that.